You are listening to the Global Security Podcast from Johns Hopkins University's Krieger School of Arts and Sciences, Advanced Academic Programs in Washington, D.C. For today's Global Security Podcast, I'm joined by Dr. Trita Parsi, who has taught for us here in the Global Security Studies program, and I hope will again, but is also president of the National Iranian American Council. He's author of a couple of important books. Yale University Press published in 2007 his book, Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Iran, Israel, and the United States. And then last year in 2012, he had out from, also from Yale University Press, A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran, a very well-received book, which in fact won an award from Foreign Affairs as the best book of 2012 on the subject of the Middle East. He's been the right man at the right time here in recent months with all that's been going on with Iran and has hit all the important cultural touchstones, gave a TED talk, I think, in the spring or summer, and more recently appeared on the Colbert Report, so probably doubtless the highlight of your career, I'm sure. So we figured that if you've done those things, then maybe we ought to have you here at the Global Security Podcast.
I qualified, finally.
There we go. Dr. Parsi has his PhD from Johns Hopkins University SAIS, where his advisor was Francis Fukuyama, and just thought we'd have him in and talk a little bit about what's going on with U.S.-Iranian relations and in Iran. So, Trita Parsi, welcome to Global Security Studies.
Thank you for having me.
So some international relations theorists would say that it's really difficult to have good, solid, positive relations with a country whose decision-making processes are, you know, opaque. Do you agree with that? And to the extent you do, you know, how much can you say that we really know about Iran's decision-making processes and what really goes on in Tehran today?
I think it is a very fair point that when the decision-making process either is opaque or, in the case of the Iranians, are deliberately very, very opaque, it does add anxiety, particularly when it's combined with an outlook by that government that is, if not hostile, at a minimum anti-status quo in the region, at least at times it has been. This does create difficulties. But at the same time, it's fair to point out that even when you have states that have opaque decision-making processes, does not necessarily mean that there has to be hostile relations. We have several examples in which we have managed to ensure decent relations, at a minimum, even with states whose decision-making process we don't necessarily fully understand. I don't view it as a decisive variable, but it is nevertheless an important variable in a context of a larger set of difficulties that exist with Iran.
Well, specifically then, what do we know about what role the Ayatollah Khamenei plays, you know, vis-a-vis the still new president, Hassan Rouhani, and how that relationship, both as a personal thing and also sort of as a matter of formal governmental processes, works? Because Rouhani is somebody, of course, that Americans are looking to, or many Americans are looking to, as, you know, sort of, in some ways, sort of a breath of fresh air, but Khamenei has been around for a long time, and to Americans seems to represent something quite different. So,
absolutely. And I think there is a certain duality in the Iranian government that at times is difficult to fully understand, or at least understand the implications of. But I think it's important to note that we don't understand that much about Iran. We don't have that much information. And part of the reason why we don't, of course, is a combination of the fact that their system is opaque and the fact that we don't have relations. For 34 years, we have not had an embassy in Iran. We have not had, in addition to that, American companies on the ground in Iran. We have not had an expat American community in Iran. For instance,
You mean that really has current active ties with Iran?
No,
certainly. There are many American, Iranian Americans.
There are a lot of Iranian Americans in the United States, but I'm talking about Americans living in Iran.
Okay, all right.
So, for instance, during the 1970s, the Israelis had superior intelligence on Iran compared to the CIA, largely because of the fact that they relied on the 100,000-man-strong Jewish Iranian community. So all of that in combination, I think, is a problem in and of itself. But I think the biggest problem is not necessarily our lack of information, is our lack of disregard for this lack of information. We are very quick to draw assumptions and, in fact, draw conclusions that actually are not conclusions. They are assumptions, but we treat them as conclusions when we deal with Iran, when we analyze Iran. That, I think, frankly, is a bigger problem than the lack of information. Lack of information you can deal with, and you can address, and you can also have an analysis that takes that into account, and you realize that it's not on completely certain ground. That's not what we're doing. We're making big decisions based on very little, if any, information, most of it being actually assumptions rather than even confirmed facts. That's the bigger problem.
So if you were running American foreign policy, how would you deal with that situation? I mean, as you say, we are in a state of very substantial ignorance. So what should be our first steps then?
Well, I think what the administration is doing right now is definitely a step in the right direction. It's a very important step. And I think it has become so complicated that it would be very difficult to open up an embassy in Tehran without first resolving the nuclear issue, or suddenly have, you know, massive influx of Iranian students and American students going to Iran without complete in isolation of the very, very tense situation that exists on a geopolitical level. So at this point, that's no longer in the cards. 15, 20 years ago, it was in the cards. I mean, remember, these sanctions, we have had 2-3 years of crippling sanctions on Iran. Then we've had about 20 years of broad sanctions on Iran. But in 1994, trade between Iran and the United States stood at $4 billion a year. And that was overwhelmingly Iranians buying American stuff, not Americans buying Iranian stuff. So there has been points in which this situation has not gotten as bad as it is now, in which you could have done other things. At this point, it appears that really not much can be done until we at least, if not resolve, contain the nuclear issue.
Which will then allow other contacts to flourish,
exactly.
Which will then provide a basis for a broader and hopefully, you know, richer diplomacy.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, for instance, one of the things I think will be very valuable, we have a report that comes out that makes the argument that what we've seen in Iran following the election of Hassan Rouhani is that a group of people within that regime, deep insiders, but who tend to view the world very differently from the hardliners, from Khamenei, etc., who don't tend to espouse the hardline narrative that the West is inherently out to get Iran, and that there is an unavoidable zero-sum relationship between Iran and the West, but who rather view it as a possibility to get to a positive-sum relationship, who are more willing to take risks for peace and understanding, and that in the past have made extensive offers of negotiations. They were catapulted into power as a result of the elections in June of this year.
So Rouhani was one of those people, and he brought more.
Absolutely. In fact, more than half of the people in the Iranian Supreme National Council was replaced as a result of these elections. And these are people who are very critical within that system. How do we do something so at a minimum we weaken the narrative of the hardliners that has been so dominant in Iran for the last 8 years, who has roots that go far deeper than this regime, in which the Iranians do tend to view themselves as being subjected by the West because they do have a potential of becoming the most powerful country in the region, which would unsettle the balance of power in the region, and who then draw the conclusion that the West inherently is looking for Iran's subjugation, prevented from advancing, particularly in the nuclear, in the scientific fields. One way one can do that is to disprove this narrative. One can, after this nuclear deal has been, after the first phase of this nuclear deal has been settled, push for scientific collaboration in various areas that have no proliferation risk, just to prove that that narrative is false, and by that, strengthen the narrative and the receptivity of the narrative of those who are willing to pursue a more collaborative and cooperative approach with the West.
We've mentioned the new president, Hassan Rouhani. What do you think, and that he doesn't subscribe to, at least to the hardline sort of, you know, narrative, mm-hmm. as you describe it, about what the United States seeks for Iran or seeks to do to Iran. What do you think his goals are, ultimately, vis-a-vis both U.S.-Iranian relations and, for that matter, Iran itself as a country? Where is he going, or where does he want to go?
Well, I always were under the impression that the hardliners in Iran were very afraid of a relationship with the United States because they felt that the relationship with the United States, they would be the weaker party, much of Iran's independence would be lost, and Iran would be forced to pursue policies that were in line in Washington, which in the long run, in their calculation, would undermine Iranian long-term security interest because that partnership or that relationship with the U.S. would put Iran on the wrong side of history from the perspective of the peoples of the region, based on the viewpoint that the United States is viewed by a very large mass of people in the Middle East as an illegitimate actor in the region, who is not looking for the best interests of the people of the region.
Because of Israel, or is it broader than that?
It's broader than that, but certainly Israel is a very important factor in that. Clearly, it's at least one of the elements of this that is easy to use to rally folks around your point of view. But that is a view that the hardliners viewed. I think, again, going back to our lack of understanding of Iran, because we didn't understand that, or perhaps because it's somewhat difficult to understand that someone would tend to view us as illegitimate, we all put this in the category, oh, they're ideological, which oftentimes has become like a catchphrase for whatever we don't understand, that must be ideological. Reality, there is a logic to it. We may completely disagree with it, and it may also be very false. It doesn't mean that it's ideological.
Or, to use an even stronger word that we sometimes hear with regard to Iran and some of the other countries that are put on the rogue list, it's not crazy.
It's not crazy. It's not irrational.
Right.
Yeah. What I've been struck by, having had conversations with very, very senior people in the Rouhani government in the last couple of weeks, I attended the nuclear talks in Geneva. I was, of course, not part of the talks, but I was there, and I also had a chance to talk to people from both sides then, was to see that also some of the folks on the more pragmatic side, perhaps as a result of them having to do an ultimate compromise with the hardliners, but nevertheless, we're not looking for a partnership with the United States. They're at best looking for some sort of a rivalry between the United States and Iran, similar to what the U.S. has currently with Russia, which means that there can be extensive collaboration, tactically, strategically, but Iran is not going to compete with Israel, Saudi Arabia, or Turkey to become America's best friend and ally and the go-to country for the U.S. in the region. On the contrary, the Iranians believe that a source of their power will be precisely because Iran will take the position of being a challenger of the American vision for the region. That would actually catapult them into a position of power which their mere economic and military force would not enable them to be at.
We talked about the nuclear deal which was recently reached. Do you want to just briefly summarize for us what that entails? And then perhaps more importantly, it's very controversial, as you know, in the United States. What's your view? I'm assuming you're of the opinion that this is, in fact, a good thing for the United States.
I think
you want to sort of talk about this set of
issues. I think absolutely it's a good thing for the United States. My heart goes out to the very, very hardworking American negotiating team who did brilliantly in these negotiations, and unfortunately have to come home to the welcoming of the accusations of surrender in Munich. I find it frankly absurd.
Munich is a much misused metaphor. I'm you know, without any regard to whether or not the Iran deal is a good one or not, I just on principle, I'll say it's not like Munich.
What this deal did, the critical elements of it is that it froze Iran's growth of its nuclear program. The Iranians are not going to be adding new centrifuges. They're going to stop their enrichment of 20% enriched uranium, and they're also going to get rid of their stockpile of 20% enriched uranium. This is important because if you want to build a bomb, you have to enrich it to 20% before you enrich it further to 93%. By them not having a stockpile of 20%, by them not having enrichment to 20% and not above 20% either, and with the inspections being much greater, which they will be as a result of this deal, the Iranians essentially will not have a detectable breakout capability. Would mean that if they were to try to cheat and build a bomb, they would be caught at the very early stage of that process, which would give the United States and the international community enough time to be able to do something about it. But perhaps more importantly, by making sure that the Iranians are also getting something out of this, you also deprive them of the incentive of cheating. And that's part of the reason why this is, unfortunately, a controversial deal in the United States.
Because we have to give them something.
We have forgotten what diplomacy means. Diplomacy means, and particularly in Congress, they have forgotten what diplomacy means because they actually behave this way vis-a-vis each other. It's all or nothing. And then they extend that to our foreign policy, towards other sovereign states, and they expect amazingly better results than what they get themselves when they're fighting each other that way within Congress. And with that mindset, from that starting point, that very inaccurate starting point, yes, everything will be controversial, because any deal, by definition, at least any durable deal, would have to give the other side something as well. I think also the administration may have undermined themselves slightly here.
How so?
Because they have vastly exaggerated the manner in which sanctions have impacted the decision-making of the regime. Sanctions have vastly impacted the economy in Iran. There's no doubt about that. The numbers speak for themselves. Oil income slashed by half. Currency slashed by almost 60 to 70%. A contraction of the economy. All of these things are absolutely true. And it's very, very painful for the population. The regime itself obviously is also affected by this, but not at all to the same extent as the population. I think part of the reason why there was such an emphasis on this was to be able to give the impression that we're negotiating from a position of strength, and that now we're strong enough, we have the Iranians in a corner, we forced them to the table, even though they were always at the table. They never left the table. Negotiations have been ongoing. There was a pause because of the U.S. election, and then there was a pause because of the Iranian elections. But no one ceased to come to the negotiating table.
Even during the Ahmadinejad period?
This was all during the Ahmadinejad year. In fact, the Ahmadinejad government signed on to an American proposal in May 2010 that the Turks and the Brazilians helped convince the Iranians to do. But then the U.S. reneged on that. But the point I'm trying to get to is that sanctions have been very, very devastating for their economy. But the reason why we had a breakthrough was because both sides compromised. Yes, sanctions bring some leverage to the United States if the United States is willing to lift them. But the reason why we had a breakthrough was because both sides recognized the other side's red line and embraced it. We gave in to each other's bottom lines. The bottom line of the Iranians was that they're going to have enrichment under 3.5% on their soil at the end of this process. That's the critical bottom line that they've insisted on for the last 10 years. For the first time, the United States essentially has accepted that. That's why we have a breakthrough.
Do you believe?
But the point I'm trying to make there is, by emphasizing sanctions so much, and because Congress imposed those sanctions, Congress is then under the impression, but hold on, if these sanctions were so miraculously awesome, why should we stop with that? And why should we have to give something to the other side when our analysis says that they're about to collapse? There should be capitulating rather than negotiating. And that is a massive misunderstanding of the balance of power here.
Do you think that the Iranians, in fact, had the intention to build a nuclear bomb? Was that ultimately the real issue from their point of view?
The real issue from their point of view, based on the information that we have, and that dates back to when this program was started during the time of the Shah, with very, very strong encouragement by Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, who at the time in the Ford administration served the government, was that the Shah wanted to make sure that he had everything in place so that he had the option of building a weapon in case the security environment in the Middle East further deteriorated. Part of the reason for this was because an American ambassador to Iran in the 1960s had made it very clear to the Shah the United States would never go to war with the Soviet Union over Iran. Iran was not a member of NATO or any major security body that provided it with that type of guarantee. At the same time, Iran had the third most technically advanced military in the world because of all the money the Iranians were spending on U.S. military equipment. So Iran did not need a nuclear weapon. It had such a strong conventional superiority vis-a-vis everyone in the region. It did not need it. But the Shah wanted to have it as an option in case he faced a different situation at some point. But he did not want to cross that line unnecessarily for several different reasons. One being, if the Shah helped nuclearize the region and there would be a spread of nuclear weapons in the region, then Iran would be at strategic parity with states much smaller than itself, and it would completely lose out on its strategic conventional superiority. That reasoning still holds inside of Iran.
But you're not arguing, are you, that that the current or recent Iranian nuclear program is merely sort of bureaucratic inertia from the Shah's days.
No, actually, during the 1980s, for a couple of years, the Ayatollah Khomeini stopped the program on religious grounds. Then he was convinced to start it, and then it accelerated after the Iraq-Iran war. Part of the reason why it accelerated, and at that point, clearly the Iranians were looking at making sure that they got quickly to an option stage, but the decision to build it, according to all intelligence, including U.S., had not been made and has still not been made. The reason why, and this may go into some of the territory you have been working on, that the Iranians did this was because at the end of the Iraq-Iran War 1988, both sides knew that this peace was not particularly durable, was very fragile, and both sides were convinced that they could not afford another war. So that led them to believe that the other side would definitely use weapons of mass destruction in the earliest possible phase of the next war. The Iranians knew that Saddam had a very advanced nuclear weapons program. They had tried to bomb it. They failed. The Israelis then finished it. The Iranians provided intelligence based on their attempts to destroy the facility to the Israelis before the Israelis bombed it. And they knew that he was still at it. And that is part of the reason why they restarted their program and they continued. Prior to 2003, there are very good reasons to believe that the Iranians were violating clear lines of the NPT and they were experimenting with weaponization. But even experimenting with weaponization is not the same thing as building a bomb or having made the political decision to build a bomb. The reasoning that Iran actually would be a net loser in the region if the region as a whole weaponized and nuclearized still holds.
Sure.
Again, it was Iran and another country in a very similar position, Egypt, that introduced the idea in 1974 of a nuclear-free and WMD-free zone in the Middle East. Two states that had the most to lose from a nuclearized region. Compare that to Israel, a much smaller state, smaller population, no strategic depth, a much different incentive structure for having nuclear weapons.
I want to go in a slightly different direction for a minute. After September 11, 2001, there were some contacts, important contacts, between the U.S. and Iran, neither of whom were particularly enthused about the Taliban or particularly enthused about al-Qaeda, for that matter. But those never really went anywhere. What happened there, and was that a squandered opportunity, or was that really sort of never going to be a big deal in any event?
Actually, no, those actually went somewhere before they were scuttled.
Okay.
They went to the place in which the Taliban was defeated with the help of the Iranians, intelligence, and military. But the most important help that the Iranians provided the United States, according to Ambassador Jim Dobbins, who was President Bush's special envoy for Afghanistan, was the political help they provided in making sure that once the Taliban was defeated, that there was a political solution in Afghanistan, contrary to what we saw in Iraq. That all culminated in the December 10th, 2001 Bonn Conference in Germany, in which a new constitution for Afghanistan was put together. Hamid Karzai became the head of that government. And this was the Iranian help, according to Dobbins, was critical because they were the ones who had political pull with the Northern Alliance and who had the ability to convince the Northern Alliance that they had to share power even with those who lost the civil war in Afghanistan in order to ensure that there would be a sustainable government and not just a new phase in the civil war. 6 weeks after this great success, which was, you know, the climax of U.S.-Iran collaboration in Afghanistan, the United States, in the State of the Union of President G.W. Bush, put Iran in the axis of evil. And this was one of the first major setbacks for those in Iran who have the mindset that there should be some attempts or collaboration with the West, that there are win-win solutions. Incidentally, those people who spearheaded and masterminded this collaboration with the United States was Hassan Rouhani, who was the National Security Advisor to the Khatami government at the time, And the person who was negotiating with Jim Dobbins, who helped Jim Dobbins, according to Jim Dobbins, was Javad Zarif, the current foreign minister. That setback, and in addition to two other setbacks that followed this, created a very negative scenario for those. And it helped vindicate the hardline narrative. The narrative that said, the West may tactically collaborate with Iran, but the minute it doesn't need Iran, it's going to go back to hostility because it's never going to accept Iran. At least it's not going to accept the Islamic Republic, nor is it going to accept Iran as a power state in the region. That narrative, the strengthening of that narrative, unfortunately helped bring about Ahmadinejad. And he took that to completely new levels, of course. And it's very interesting because we kind of got lucky to see this narrative, at least temporarily, having been unseated. And it's only because of the elections. Well, otherwise, there were the people who held that view of being willing to collaborate were completely marginalized within the Iranian political spectrum up until this election.
You mentioned Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who was for, 8 years, I guess, something like this, president of Iran. And when Ahmadinejad talked about Israel, what Americans, most Americans, and I think almost all Israelis heard was basically threats to destroy Israel, which obviously have a certain historical resonance. Was that a correct reading in your view of what Ahmadinejad was really saying and really meaning?
It was not a correct reading of what he actually said. But frankly, I'm not so sure if it matters.
Why is that?
The degree of hostile rhetoric that Ahmadinejad used was so venomous and was so completely void of any understanding of the emotional reaction it would have on the other side. When the Ahmadinejad folks decided to start questioning the Holocaust, this was a deliberate attempt by them seeking to raise the pressure on Israel to punish it for having made Iran's nuclear issue an international issue. The idea was that you either play offense or you play defense. So instead of having Israel put Iran under a microscope, the Iranians were going to readdress issues that Israel thought that he had already put to rest, such as, does it have a right to exist or not? Issues that may have been much more hotly debated 30 years ago, but after the peace process, even though it never came to, at least so far has not come to a successful conclusion, nevertheless, de facto got settled. This was a deliberate effort, but there was a complete misunderstanding of what type of emotions and pictures and images and memories it brings to light when starting to question the Holocaust. And even if the quote about wiping Israel off the map was completely incorrect, there's two important points there to remember. The translation was not made by the Western media. The incorrect translation was made by the Iranians themselves. What Ahmadinejad said, he was actually trying to quote Khomeini from 1981 when he said that the Zionist entity would evaporate from the pages of time. He misquoted him and said the Zionist entity will evaporate from the pages of history. But already back in 1981, the Iranians translated that as wipe Israel off the map. But note that neither the word Israel, wipe, or map is in the Persian version of this. And in 2005, the Iranians reused that translation. So it was not a Western conspiracy of making up this quote. It was the Iranians that provided this false.
They inflicted this on themselves.
Exactly. But more importantly, even if we set that aside, the quote that has been repeated that is not inaccurately translated and that is said over and over again, particularly by Khamenei, is that Israel is a cancerous tumor and to free yourself from cancer, you have to remove the tumor. Now, it doesn't say that it's Iran's job to do so, nor does it say that Iran will do so. But it nevertheless is not a particularly friendly statement towards Israel. So the damage, I would say, Ahmadinejad did to the Iranians themselves by using such a hostile rhetoric, it's going to take a while to fully be able to assess. I don't think, for instance, the very impressive degree of international backing for the sanctions would have been possible had it not been for the way Ahmadinejad had this knack of just turning everyone off. In fact, the Bush administration never even dared to dream about some of the sanctions that the Obama administration later on was able not only to impose, but to get other countries to abide by. And I think Ahmadinejad deserves a lot of credit for Obama's success in this.
That's an interesting perspective, okay.
But it's also important to note that as problematic as that rhetoric is, that rhetoric was also very much being used in the 1980s by Khomeini himself. And at that time, because of a different geopolitical situation, the Israelis were the ones in Washington who were lobbying for Iran, lobbying Washington to talk to Iran, to sell arms to Iran, and not pay attention to this rhetoric. Because the argument was that the rhetoric is not reflective of the actual policy. Back then, of course, the Israelis were actively helping the Iranians, wanted to make sure that Iran did not lose the war to Saddam Hussein, but also because they wanted to bring back Iran into the Western fold, because Iran had been a close ally of Israel during the time of the Shah, and regardless of the change of regime, regardless of their ideology, regardless of their rhetoric, the Israelis wanted to make sure that Iran would come back into the Western fold.
So Ahmadinejad is gone now, and we are, as we've been discussing through most of this conversation, in the Rouhani era. Is Israel and is Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu right to be afraid of Iran today?
Iran and Israel do pose challenges to each other. And Iran certainly has the ability to be a very grave threat to Israel. I think 2006 in Lebanon showed that through Hezbollah, the Iranians have a very effective deterrence and a retaliatory capability against Israelis. But it's a different thing to be a threat than to be an existential threat. Netanyahu has successfully managed to convince large portions of the Israeli public that Iran is an existential threat. He has not managed to convince a large portion, or an equally large portion at least, of people in the intelligence and defense complexes of Israel that that is the case. That's not to say that they don't view Iran as a threat, but existential threat is a different matter. Very senior people in Israel with more military experience than Netanyahu are quite open and frank about this. Ehud Barak, the most decorated soldier in Israeli history, has since 1992 consistently, publicly rejected the notion that Iran constitutes an existential threat. His argument being, how could it be? Israel is so powerful. It would be demeaning to Israel's security forces to say that Iran is an existential threat. At the end of the day, it doesn't even have nuclear weapons, whereas Israel does. And Israel, in addition, has second strike capabilities.